Good afternoon, everybody. Shmuel Plotzker coming at you live from beautiful Mount Washington, a suburb here of Cincinnati, Ohio. Outside Dr. Beth Munzel's office on Beachmont Avenue, and we're going to begin. If you're calling in right now, you're calling in for a book club class, and Gulf Manor Synagogue School of Jewish Studies is going to be starting a wonderful, monumental book by the late, great Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, and the book is called A Letter in the Scroll, Understanding Our Jewish Identity and Exploring the Legacy of the World's Oldest Religion. We picked this book because we needed a new book. We were finishing up Redemption Unfolding, and I was mindful of the fact that we have a Sefer Torah campaign going on at Gulf Manor Synagogue in honor of our 120th anniversary. And then I came across an old Moment magazine, you know, a magazine dedicated to Jewish culture and art and literature and so on. And there was a section there in this September-October of 2019 edition where they asked various people, rabbis, professors, what five books do you recommend in order to be an educated Jew? So Erica Brown, who runs the Maybrook Center for Jewish Education and Leadership at GW, weighed in, and she gives five books, one by David Wolpe, Why Faith Matters, Judaism for Dummies by Ted Falcon and David Blattner, Nine Questions People Ask About Judaism by Prager and Telushkin, a really great book. Read that when I was much, much younger, in my teen years. Very, very beautiful book. And The Great Religion is Judaism by Isaiah Gaffney, who I think is over in Israel and I think at Hebrew University. She recommends that course, that series, and also she recommends A Letter in the Scroll. Here's what she writes. It's not enough to know facts about Judaism. You have to develop a relationship to Judaism so that the facts are important and that you see yourself as part of the story. This book, which Sacks wrote as a wedding present for his son, helps situate readers very personally within Jewish tradition. Sacks wants Jews to stop seeing themselves as history's victims and instead focus on how Judaism has persisted and flourished and how Jews have made their mark on Western civilization. It helps that Sacks, an international voice for faith, writes with an angel's pen. And that he does. I've gotten about 40, 50 pages into the book, and every letter, every word is a pleasure, every page is a pleasure. So let's get right to it. We will rediscover.
Oh, and by the way, Small.
Yes, Barry.
I know that most people say Judaism is one of the oldest religions, but I'm sure that they, when they went down to Egypt, they already had a religion in Egypt that Pharaoh was God. And so I don't know that from the current picks, you could say it's the oldest of the three that is believable or whatever. But I don't know if it really was the oldest religion, because even when Abraham was going to be thrown into, even when Abraham was going to be thrown into the furnace, you know, they must have had their own religious beliefs. So I can't say Judaism is the oldest religion.
Okay, good point. The only thing I got is that there is a rabbinic teaching that Adam understood who God was, and then his children ultimately did, and Chanoch, we gave a whole talk about Chanoch about a year ago, and he was a monotheist, and Mr. Shelach, who was either his son or his own father, I can't remember which. So he was a monotheist, and Noach was a monotheist. Now, were they worshiping? Were they celebrating and doing Judaism is the question. Were they doing Jewish rituals?
They may have been doing a certain aspect, but that was, I don't know if before it started to branch off, I don't know if that would be called a religion or it just was a knowledge of God and what have you. The idea of having religions didn't split off until later, and the Jewish faith did not start really, if everybody wants to say Abraham, Yitzhak, Yaakov, but it really didn't start in its form that we call Judaism until Sinai.
Yeah, another good point. That's true. But the rabbis are going to insist, as we saw in our speech on Shavuos night, we saw that God himself testifies that Abraham kept Mishmarti Chukosai V'Sorosai, my commands, my rituals, my laws, my teachings, and so on. I mean, God says that about Abraham. So what does God mean by that? The oral tradition, in addition to the written word, and the rabbis insist that Abraham kept all the oral tradition. So, of course, there are questions, and we explored some of those questions during the class. But if you were to ask me what religion goes back, I'd have to say I don't like calling paganism a religion. I'm not comfortable calling a belief in Pharaoh a religion, but I think you do make a point when you say that, because the people had a faith in something, and they believed that the Nile was the god, that a goat was a god, that the Pharaoh was a god. Academics tell you that they believed that the sun was a god. So they did believe in, they were pagans. They did have a belief in paganistic ideas, anything but the one true monotheistic god. So I think I'm hard-pressed to beat you. I think it'd be difficult to beat you on the idea
could we call it a religion if there's only a few people that, hold by it? Does it really become a religion?
Yeah. I believe that it's a religion even if only a couple people hold by it. I'm not troubled by that. I'm not troubled by the fact that only one man and his family, kept a certain belief system. There's a belief system and it's out there. And the Hebrews did it. Abraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, his boys, they had this belief. And we must not forget that even according to the Bible, Abraham made converts. Because he did. I mean, it's not just a rabbinical tradition, although that's very authoritative too. But that's a nefesh asher asu b'charon. It says it right there. And the soul, in the singular, it means the souls in the plural. The souls that they made in Haran, they were doing some proselytization, and there is an idea that Abraham was a very successful, advocate for the one true God. So there were people believing in monotheism in Abraham's time, and Abraham was leading them to that belief. So the question is, what about everybody who came before Abraham? Well, you did have monotheists. You had Melchizedek. He was a contemporary of Abraham. He believed in the one true God. Noah did, Shem, his son, did. From Shem came all us Semites. It's a great thing. It's a great question to ask. There was tension between the monotheists and the pagans way, way back when. But I'll grant you that in ancient Egypt and in ancient Mesopotamia, they were pagans. That I will grant you, and there's no denying that they were pagans. They believed in something other than the one true God. Good point. It's a good point. And that was something of a faith. It looked like a religion to me. They had rituals, they had priests, they had beliefs, they believed in something as a god. They did believe it. And I think I feel funny calling that a religion, but what else would you call it? So I think you make a good point. I think you do make a good point. Just that I feel uncomfortable calling paganism a religion. The pagan religion. It just sounds weird to say those words. There's the Jewish religion, the Islamic faith, and the pagan religion. It just sounds funny saying. But it may be, just because it makes feels funny to me doesn't make it, wrong. I think you make a point. So we have to think about that. There was certainly paganism and very active paganism in Abraham's day. But Abraham was preceded by monotheists. Can't deny that. Mr. Shelah, Hanoch, Noach, they exist, Shem, they existed before Abraham. So there was certainly monotheism in the world. Also a point to be made. We're in the preface. Remember, this is a thoughtful gift that Rabbi Jonathan Sachs writes to his son, who is getting married to his wife Eve. His son Judah is marrying his Kala Eve, and Rabbi Sachs writes a book to honor his son and his new-to-be daughter-in-law. He writes as follows in the preface. Today, throughout the diaspora, one Jew in two is either marrying out or not marrying, or in some other way, deciding not to create a Jewish home, have Jewish children, and continue the Jewish story. At such moments, rare in our history, we or our children face the question, who am I, and why should I remain a Jew? That question can never be answered in the abstract. It is intensely personal and demands a personal reply. This is my personal reply. By the way, he wrote this book 20 to 21 years ago. I think the frontispiece says, 21 years ago, copyright in the year 2000. This is my personal reply, says Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, to the question, who am I, and why should I remain a Jew? None of us can answer this question for anyone else, but it sometimes helps to know how other people have thought about it, which is why I have decided to publish this book as an open letter to the next generation. Writing it turned out to be, for me, a journey of discovery. Time and again, as I asked, not what, but why? To my surprise, I found Judaism disclosing itself to me in a way I had not seen before. So at the heart of the story I have to tell is my own theology of Judaism, something I have never previously written. The more I penetrated into the mystery of Jewish survival, the more clearly I saw the originality, the distinctiveness, the sheer sanity of its vision of the world and of mankind, and how little it is understood by ourselves and the others even now. We need to go back to our texts. Crisis is creative. It allows us, as more settled times do not, to encounter an ancient heritage afresh. I presented the first draft of this book to our son Joshua and daughter-in-law Eve on the day of their wedding. It is my gift to them. It is also a tribute to my late father of blessed memory and to what I learned from him. This is my yisker, my prayer to his memory. I should have read this a million times before now. This way I wouldn't get choked up. No matter, because if you're doing a show or reading a book and it chokes you up, it's a good thing. But, if you got to get through it, then probably should have read it out loud a dozen times. Then I wouldn't be getting all emotional. I just love this. Turns to his son. It's both a testimony about his own life and his own finding of Judaism, and he's giving that to the next generation, and he's dedicating it to the previous generation. He's living in three different generations. He's invoking the memory of his late father. He's telling us all about himself. And he's giving that story to his son as a way to keep the story going. The Jewish story, that is. It is a beautifully rendered book. Let's finish this off. This is my yisker, my prayer to my father's memory. For when Jews remember, they do so for the future. The place where, if we are faithful to it, the past never dies. My dear friends, a letter in the scroll. Prologue. A group of Jewish university students had come to see me. They were planning their course for the next year, and they wondered whether I could suggest a theme. That is unintelligible to an American. What Rabbi Jonathan Sacks just wrote makes no sense to an American who went to college. A group of Jewish university students came to see him. They were planning their course for the next year, and they wondered whether I could suggest a theme. What does that even, what does it mean? What it means is, well, you could think it means they're planning on studying something in college, and they go to the rabbi for advice as to what he's going to advise them, what course load they should take. Do you suggest a theme? What do you think we should learn about this year, you know, that Professor Goldberg is going to offer? You could say that, but I think you'd be very wrong if you said that, because later on it's going to become clearer. What really is going on over here is a group of Jewish university students came to see him because he was going to offer a class in a Jewish topic. They were planning their course for next year. And apparently Rabbi Sacks is going to allow them to suggest to him what they wanted to learn. What do you want to learn about this year? Jewish history? Should we study the Mishnah? How about the Talmud? Should we study something in mystical studies, maybe the Kabbalah, I don't know, Jewish philosophy? So they were wondering whether he, the teacher, could suggest a theme. What are we going to learn this coming year, Rabbi Sacks? What are you going to teach us? So they were coming to get some advice. Well, let's discuss what we're going to learn. What are you going to teach us this year? What should it be? That's how I understand this. And you'll see it's going to be borne out. I thought for a moment, and then I suggested this. There are many Jews today doing interesting and significant things. There are artists and academics, judges and doctors, politicians and heads of voluntary organizations, writers and journalists. Their work must raise, in a myriad ways, important questions about what to do and how to live. Write to them and ask them whether they would give you a brief personal statement about what being a Jew means to them and how it makes a difference to their lives. You will then have a series of texts that you'll be able to compare with some of the classic statements of our tradition. You will be able to listen to the voices of the past and those of the present. And between them, you can construct a fascinating series of discussions on what being a Jew might mean to you. The students were excited by the suggestion, and during the weeks that followed, we exchanged ideas about whom to ask and how to construct the questions. Months passed, and hearing no more about the project, I inquired about its progress. Top of page 2. They told me that they had sent out almost 200 letters and received only 6 replies. These were 3 of them. The first came from a famous and distinguished Jewish academic. He wrote, quote, "I am quite incapable of writing even a short passage on what being Jewish means to me. All that I think is that I am a Jew in exactly the sense in which I have 2 legs, arms, eyes, etc. It is just an attribute which I take for granted as belonging to me, part of the minimum description of me as a person. I am neither proud of it nor embarrassed by it. I am just a Jew, and it never occurred to me that I could be anything else. The question, why be Jewish, is something that I cannot answer any more than why be alive or why be two-legged." The second came from a noted Jewish writer. Quote, "Jewishness is a source of comfort and reassurance to me and gives me a sense of belonging to a proud and ancient community. But all that is entirely due to the fact that I was brought up as a Jew. I have no doubt that I would have felt the same had I been brought up as a Catholic, Protestant, Muslim, Buddhist, or Hottentot. And I do not know what a Hottentot is, other than it sounds like a Dr. Seuss word. Are you hot? No. Are you a Hottentot? No. I mean, it just sounds, I don't even know what that is. And I've been around a little bit. I have no idea what a Hottentot is. So if anybody does, let me know. End quote. I mean, Hottentot, end quote. The rest of that was mine. The third came from an Israeli, prominent in public life in Israel and the diaspora. Quote, one of the most interesting definitions of Judaism that I know is something that I heard a number of years ago from a young Israeli boy. Judaism, he said, is a hereditary illness. You get it from your parents and also pass it along to your children. And why call it an illness, I ask? Because not a small number of people have died from it, he answered. End quote. People have died for being Jewish. Top page 3. The students felt left down. They felt let down. And to be honest, so did I. Here were three Jews, none of them hostile to Judaism or the Jewish people, two religiously committed, and the third, famous for his defense of some central Jewish values. Each had taken the trouble to write a message to the next generation. Yet the message itself was strangely ambivalent. For the first two, being Jewish was a mere accident of birth. For the third, it was worse than an accident. It was an illness. The students felt, and I agreed, that there was nothing here on which a college course could be built. There you have it. They were looking to him to create a college course for the semester. What are we going to learn? Let's learn about being Jewish. And they got back these terrible replies. Rabbi Sachs continues in his prologue. So the next time I addressed the student group, I read them these responses. Then I asked them to listen to some other voices reflecting on Judaism and the Jewish people. I read to them these words by the great Russian novelist Leo Tolstoy. Quote, the Jew is that sacred being who has brought down from heaven the everlasting fire and has illumined with it the entire world. He is the religious source, spring, and fountain out of which all the rest of the peoples have drawn their beliefs and their religions. End quote. And these, by the 19th century American president, John Adams. Quote, I will insist that the Hebrews have done more to civilize men than any other nation. If I were an atheist and believed in blind eternal fate, I should still believe that fate had ordained the Jews to be the most essential instrument for civilizing the nations. If I were an atheist of the other sect who believe or pretend to believe that all is ordered by chance, I should believe that chance had ordered the Jews to preserve and propagate to all mankind the doctrine of a supreme, intelligent, wise, almighty sovereign of the universe, which I believe to be the great essential principle of all morality, and consequently of all civilization. End quote.
And Shmuel, a Hottentot is slang for a nomadic indigenous people of South Africa.
Thank you so much. Nomadic indigenous peoples of South Africa. Those are the Hottentots. Thank you. I never would have known that.
Probably just like the Mayans in Central America.
Like the Mayans in Central America. These are the Hottentots. Thank you, Barry. Well done. Page 4. Shkoyach. I read them this passage by the contemporary historian Paul Johnson. quote, "All the great conceptual discoveries of the intellect seem obvious and inescapable once they have been revealed, but it requires a special genius to formulate them for the first time." The Jews had this gift. To them we owe the idea of equality before the law, both divine and human, of the sanctity of life and the dignity of the human person, of the individual conscience, and so of personal redemption, of the collective conscience, and so of social responsibility, of peace as an abstract ideal, and love as the foundation of justice, and many other items which constitute the basic moral furniture of the human mind. Without the Jews, it might have been a much emptier place. End quote. And lastly, this, by the economist and former editor of the Times of London, William Rees Mogg. Quote, "One of the gifts of Jewish culture to Christianity is that it has taught Christians to think like Jews. And any modern man who has not learned to think as though he were a Jew can hardly be said to have learned to think at all." End quote. These were astonishing accolades. And of course there were sympathetic voices. But the irony is that had I chosen unsympathetic voices, the writings of anti-Semites, they would have attributed even greater power to the Jews, whom they saw as exercising an almost total influence over the media, the economy, and the politics of the West. I'm on page 5. Here were conflicting testimonies, and reflecting on them, I found myself in the presence of not one mystery, but two. Who were and are this people who have exercised so great an influence on Western civilization? And why this strange contrast between what non-Jews and Jews have to say about them? Why was it that while non-Jews saw in Jews and Judaism something extraordinary, Jews themselves went to such elaborate lengths to deny it, to claim the virtue of being ordinary, as if it were a rare and special achievement? This much was clear to me, that there is confusion and demoralization at the heart of contemporary Jewish identity. But there is also the hint of something vast and impressive. Another quotation came to mind, this time by the American Jewish writer Milton Himmelfarb. Quote, "Each Jew knows how thoroughly ordinary he is. Yet, yet taken together, we seem caught up in things great and inexplicable. The number of Jews in the world is smaller than a small statistical error in the Chinese census. Yet we remain bigger than our numbers. Big things seem to happen around us and to us." End quote. What is it about this thoroughly ordinary people that lifts it up time and again into, quote, "things great and inexplicable"? End quote. And why are so many Jews unaware of it? 130. And why are so many Jews unaware of it? I'm on page 6. Without meaning to, I had wandered into some of the most perplexing questions about Jewish existence, past and present. Good luck. I discovered how hard it has become for Jews to say why they are Jews and why, if they do, they want the Jewish story to continue. That is what started me on a journey of self-discovery. Quote, "People ask me why I am a Jew," end quote. It was with these words that the French writer Edmund Flaig began his book, Why I Am a Jew, published in 1927. More than 70 years later, I felt the need to do the same. Flaig wrote his book at a time when there were widespread defections from Judaism. And so have I. In many ages, questions like these would have been unnecessary. Our ancestors were Jews because their parents were Jews. And so were their parents back across the centuries to ancient times. That is how Judaism and the Jewish people survived. In no small measure, that is what it is to be a Jew, to inherit a faith from those who came before us, to live it, and to hand it on to those who will come after us. To be a Jew is to be a link in the chain of the generations. But there are times when the chain begins to break, when the continuity of Judaism and the Jewish people can no longer be taken for granted. Flaig's was one, ours is another. At such moments, questions are unavoidable. Who are we? Of what story are we a part? Why were our ancestors so determined that it should continue? Does what spoke to them speak to us? More than 3,000 years ago, Moses made a request that has echoed down the ages. Speaking to the Israelites who were about to enter the Promised Land, he said, quote, "And you shall teach these things to your children, speaking of them when you are at home or on the way, when you lie down and when you rise up," end quote. Moses was the leader of a small and injured people. They had been slaves. Now they were free. They had set out on a long and torturous journey through the desert, and they had not yet reached their destination. Page 7. They were not a people to inspire confidence. They were quarrelsome, ungrateful, indecisive, and at times disloyal. Yet Moses sensed that something great had happened to them, something whose significance went far beyond that time, that place, and this people. He believed, no, he knew that this people would be the carriers of an eternal message, one that would have an effect not only on itself, but on the civilization of the world. But only if successive generations of Jews took it upon themselves to hand down their beliefs to their children and their children's children. Just before Moses said these words, he made an even more poignant request. Quote, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might," end quote. The 16th century commentator of Moshe Alshach was surely right when he said that these two verses are connected, which can only pass on to our children what we ourselves love. We cannot order our children to be Jews. We cannot deprive them of their choice, nor can we turn them into our clones. All we can do is show them what we believe and let them see the beauty of how we live. As the English poet William Wordsworth said, quote, "What we love, others will love, and we will show them how," end quote. I cannot tell my children and grandchildren what they should be. Only they can make that choice, and I wish them blessing in whatever they decide. But I can tell them where we came from and where our ancestors were traveling to and why it was important to them that their children should carry on the journey. This is our story, unfinished yet, and there is a chapter only they can write. Here I go again. Tough to read this book. Part one. The question. Saddle up. It's going to be quite a question he's going to ask. Chapter one. Why be Jewish? Sometimes you can identify the moment when a critical question is asked for the first time. My journey into Jewish identity begins 500 years ago in Spain, in a place called Calatayud, in the study of the rabbi of the town, Rabbi Isaac ben Moses Arama. By the way, he's known as the Akedat Yitzchak. That was the sefer that he wrote. Rabbi Yitzchak Arama, the Akedat Yitzchak. That's Rabbi Sachs. He has already gained, he's putting you back in time. He's placing you back 500 years. Here we go. He has already gained a wide reputation for his addresses, for they have broken new ground. They are not brief homilies, but extended reflections on Jewish philosophy, which take off from some problem in the biblical portion of the week and then soar into the heights of theological speculation. There is a sense of an ending, for the year is coming to a close. The Jewish New Year is at hand. We have reached the Torah portion of Nitzavim, near the end of the book of Deuteronomy, in which Moses, at the end of his life, renews this covenant of Sinai, some 40 years later, with the members of the new generation. Quote, "All of you are standing today in the presence of the Lord your God, your leaders and chief men, your elders and officials, and all the other men of Israel, together with your children and your wives." And the aliens living in your camps will chop your wood and carry your water. You are standing here in order to enter into a covenant with the Lord your God. A covenant, the Almighty, I'm going to change the word Lord. I cannot stand that word. That's become Christianized. I don't use it. A covenant which that God is making with you this day and sealing with an oath to confirm you this day as his people, that he may be your God as he promised you and as he swore to your fathers Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I am making this covenant with its oath, not only with you, who are standing here with us today in the presence of the Almighty God, but also with those who are not here with us today. End quote. The words are familiar, but a question has occurred to him. Good. This is the way he usually starts a sermon. But as he searches for an answer, he finds himself becoming more enmeshed in perplexity. With a tremor, he realizes that this is no ordinary question, for it threatens to unravel his entire life's work, and indeed, his very identity. Eventually, he finds an answer and delivers the sermon. But the question has not gone away. The question, as he eventually formulated it, was this. Moses stated that he was making the covenant not only with those who were there, but also with those who were not there. To whom was he referring as not having been there? Clearly, he did not mean members of the nations at that time. They were all there, as the text makes emphatically clear. Nor was he referring to the previous generation. They had already accepted the covenant at Mount Sinai. He meant, as Rashi explains, those who were not yet born the generations to come. Hence the vital importance of this text. It is the very basis of Jewish destiny, the collective immortality of the people of Israel. Top page 13. The covenant will be eternal. It will bind all future generations. Jews will be born into its obligations. Each will be, in the Talmudical phrase, Mushba v'omed misinai, already forsworn at Sinai. There is no need for assent, consent, or confirmation. Converts accepted, Jews did not become Jews. They are Jews by birth. Jewish identity, then, is not only a faith, but a fate. It is not an identity we assume, but one into which we are born. That is the proper understanding of the passage as Jewish tradition, and Rabbi Aaron Ma himself had always read it. For the first time, though, Aaron Ma saw a gap in the logical structure of the covenant. Obligation presupposes consent. I am bound by the promises I make, but I am not bound by the promises you make, unless I agree. There is a rule in Jewish law that someone can impose a benefit on another person without his knowledge. Because he gains, we can therefore assume his agreement. But by the same token, someone cannot impose an obligation on another person without his knowledge, for there is no reason to assume that he would agree. For that reason, children do not inherit their parents' debts unless property was explicitly mortgaged to meet them. Now, undoubtedly, it is a benefit to be born a Jew, but it is also very demanding. A Jew is bound by 613 commandments. There are restrictions and obligations that he would not have had were he not a Jew. Therefore, we cannot impose this status on a person in his absence without, that is to say, his explicit consent. But that is just what Moses was doing on the banks of the Jordan. He was asking the Israelites to bind their descendants, not yet born, to keep the covenant. That meant imposing obligations on them in their absence without their agreement. How could one generation bind its successors? Top 14. How could children be born into duties to which they had not given their consent? How was the eternity of the covenant morally possible? The rabbi knew that there was a traditional answer, one that went back to an early rabbinical interpretation. According to this, the souls of all future generations of Jews were present at Mount Sinai. They heard the voice of God. They witnessed revelation. They signaled their assent. But for the first time, Aaron Ma realized that this answer would not do. He puts it this way. A person is a combination of body and soul. Absent one, and personhood is lacking. Without a soul, the body is lifeless. Without a body, the soul floats in air. But the two experience the Torah differently. To the soul, God's command is a delight. To the body, it is a series of constraints. How, then, does it solve the problem to say that the souls of future generations accepted the Torah? Naturally, they would. It is not the soul that might register an objection, but the body. If, then, future generations were not physically present at Mount Sinai, we cannot take their agreement for granted. The moral agent, body and soul together, simply was not there. The mystical answer does not answer the moral question. Do we all have it? Do we all get this? Any questions out there? How is Moshe, how is God binding anybody you need body and soul in this world to go along with that kind of thing. And you're telling me that the souls were there. Wow, that's fabulous. I'm so happy to hear that the souls were there. But the bodies were not there. And bodies were necessary in order to be able to raise objections. And there were no bodies there, literally none. Just about, I mean, outside of, obviously outside of the ones who were there. But we're talking about future generations. Oh, the souls were there. What about their bodies? Coming down some cold. It's always strange to get a cold when it's 90 degrees outside. It's a weird thing. So it's not 90 degrees in my house. You kind of keep it cooler. Anyway, the mystical answer, he says, does not answer the moral question. Isaac Arama eventually proposed a solution. But what has brought me back across the centuries to revisit him in his study that evening is this, that to my knowledge, this was the first time the question had been asked in more than 1,000 years. In essence, Arama was raising the most fundamental of questions. Why am I a Jew? How can the mere fact that my parents were Jews obligate me? How can I be bound by a covenant enacted long ago in the desert by my distant ancestors? Though the vast literature of early and medieval rabbinic Judaism raises almost every conceivable issue, this one question is conspicuous by its absence. Top 15. The very fact that a question of this kind is posed testifies to a crisis because it calls into question something that at all other times is taken for granted. For centuries, Spain had been the home of medieval Jewry's golden age. Under relatively liberal regimes, Jews had risen to eminence in business, the sciences, and public life. Their expertise was sought in finance, medicine, and diplomacy. They sustained a rich intellectual and cultural life. Jewish learning flourished. Spanish Jewry was noted for its achievements in Jewish law, mysticism, and philosophy. But the Jews of Spain were also well-versed in the wider culture, and they made fine contributions to its poetry, politics, astronomy, medicine, and cartography. They were never totally secure. There were periodic attempts to convert them to Christianity. In 1263, the Jewish community was summoned to a public disputation. The Jewish spokesman, Nachmanides, successfully refuted the arguments of his opponent, but he had to pay a price. 2 years later, he was sentenced to exile, although I thought he ran away on his own. But okay, he is a man. Then in 1391, there was a volcanic explosion of anti-Jewish feeling. Throughout Spain, there were riots. Synagogues were burned. Houses and businesses were looted, and many Jews were killed. I did not know that before reading this book. For the first time, significant numbers of Jews converted to Christianity. For the next 100 years, there was wave after wave of conversionary activity, accompanied by anti-Jewish legislation. Jews who converted were offered equal citizenship. Those who remained Jewish were confined to special areas, forced to wear distinctive clothing, barred from public life, and forbidden to mix with Christians. Eventually, in 1492, the remaining Jews were expelled. Top 16. There had been forced conversions before, under both Christian and Islamic rule, but never in such numbers or with such prominence. In the 11th century, Judah Halevi wrote in the Kuzari about the faithfulness of oppressed Jews who, with a word lightly spoken, could have ended their misery by joining the faith of their oppressors. In his day, the number of converts was small, and he could speak with pride of the heroic resistance of most Jews, who preferred to stay Jewish and suffer rather than desert their faith for the sake of gain. A century later, the picture was darker. Moses Maimonides, the greatest rabbi of the Middle Ages, was approached for advice by the Jewish community of Rottenburg. So you had the Khuzri in the 11th century, the 1000s. Rashi lived then too. And then a century later, in the 1100s, or the 12th century, you have Rambam, the greatest rabbi of the medieval period, the Middle Ages. He was approached for advice by the Jewish community in Yemen. A fanatical Shiite Muslim movement was threatening to wipe out Jews who did not convert to Islam. Many did convert. What made things worse was that one of the converts, Samuel, son of Rabbi Yehuda ibn Abbas, that the son became a missionary to the Jews. Harassed and demoralized, the community turned to Maimonides, who in 1172 replied in a long letter to them known as the Epistle to Yemen. He comforted the Jews who remained, telling them that, quote, these trials are designed to test and purify us, end quote. In fact, he said the Jews who converted were not really Jews, since, quote, God has given assurance that not only did all the persons who were present at the Sinaitic revelation believe in the prophecy of Moshe and his law, but that their descendants would do so until the end of time. End quote. Since all future generations had committed themselves at Mount Sinai, those who defected to another faith merely showed that they were not really Jews. They were not the true descendants of those who stood at Sinai. So Halevi and Maimonides knew about Jews who left Judaism. They were called conversos or anusim, forced converts, top page 17. But not until the mass conversions of 14th and 15th century Spain did the phenomenon provoke a crisis of faith within Jewry itself. Jews were leaving in great numbers. Many, Maranos, as they came to be known, continued to practice Judaism in secret. Those who refused to make such a compromise saw their kinsmen held in honor while they were persecuted. So for the first time, a question came to be asked. Why should I remain a Jew? Why should the mere fact that my parents were Jews obligate me to continue? Why should I suffer because of my faith? We have evidence that these questions troubled the minds of even the most faithful Jews. Don Isaac Abravanel, contemporary of Rabbi Arama, was the most distinguished Jew of his age. He had been treasurer to King Alfonso V of Portugal and a member of the court of Ferdinand and Isabel of Castile. He was also an outstanding Jewish scholar and wrote a great biblical commentary, still studied today. He lived through the Spanish expulsion and he escaped to Naples, where he wrote a commentary to the Haggadah. In the course of this work, he makes an extraordinary confession. There were moments during those tragic years when, he says, he came close to feeling that, quote, all the peoples who prophesied about my redemption and salvation are false. Moses, may he rest in peace, was false in his utterances. Isaiah lied in his consolations. Jeremiah and Ezekiel lied in their prophecies. And likewise, all the other prophets. Let the people remember all the despairing things they used to say at the time of the exile. End quote. This tone of despair, too, is unprecedented in more than 1,000 years. When Jews ask the question, why be Jewish, we know that we are in the presence of a major crisis in Jewish life. I know of only 4 such occasions in Jewish history. Top 18. The first occurred in the wake of the destruction of the first temple in 586 before the Common Era. In exile in Babylonia, Jews might have gone the way of the 10 tribes of the northern kingdom, who a century and a half earlier had assimilated and disappeared. The book of Ezekiel tells us that there were Jews who argued, quote, we want to be like the nations, like the other peoples of the earth, end quote. In other words, they no longer wanted to be Jews. The second crisis occurred after the destruction of the Second Temple and the later Hadrianic persecutions. A passage in the Babylonian Talmud states that, quote, by rights we should issue a decree against ourselves not to get married and have children, so that the seed of Abraham comes to an end of its own accord, end quote. So great are our sufferings that we should simply not bring any more Jews into the world. Another passage from the same period raises the following question. If a master sells his slave, or a husband divorces his wife, does he then have any further claim on them? End quote. God had handed his people over to the Romans. He no longer ruled their destiny. He had failed to protect them from defeat and savage reprisals. By what right, then, could he lay claim to their loyalty? Why should they continue to be Jews? The third occurred, as we have seen, in 15th century Spain. For the first time, Jews converted to another faith in significant numbers. Those who did so seemed to prosper. Those who remained loyal to their faith suffered ever-increasing persecution. In times like these, what answer could rabbis like Arama and Abravanel give to someone who asked, why should I remain a Jew? The fourth crisis has occurred in our time. For 60 years, Jews throughout Europe were the victims of a crescendo of anti-Semitism, culminating in the shattering tragedy of the Holocaust. Where was God when his people were being insulted, humiliated, attacked, degraded, and eventually rounded up and murdered in their millions? Elie Wiesel put it simply, the Jewish people entered into a covenant with God. We were to protect his Torah, and he in turn assumes responsibility for Israel's presence in the world. Well, it seems for the first time in history, this very covenant is broken. End quote. Wiesel was wrong in only one respect. It was not the first but the fourth time that the Jewish people had experienced this crisis. From a Jewish perspective, crisis is experienced in the widespread feeling that the covenant between Israel and God has collapsed. God had promised that the Jewish people would survive. Four times in 4,000 years, it seemed that survival was in doubt. The Babylonian conquest, the Roman persecutions, the Spanish expulsion, and the Holocaust could easily have brought about the end of the Jewish people. In the first two instances, Jews lost their sovereignty. In the third, they lost their hope of finding security somewhere in the diaspora. In the fourth, one-third of Jewish people lost their lives. What haunts us today, however, is that the fourth crisis did not end with the liberation of the camps and the conclusion of the Second World War. It continues in a new and troubling form. At present, throughout most communities in the diaspora, one young Jew in two is in effect deciding not to continue the Jewish story by living a Jewish life, marrying another Jew, and having Jewish children and grandchildren. Jewish identity in the contemporary world is being transformed from fate to choice, from a fact of birth to a consciously chosen commitment. And significant numbers of young Jews are evidently unwilling to make that commitment. The future of the Jewish people is once again at risk, this time without the backup of external persecution. The question, why be Jewish, is being raised again in a new and certain, the question, why be Jewish, is being raised again in a new and searching form. Top page 20, and we'll end with this last paragraph. Judaism is a religion of continuity. It depends for its very existence on the willingness of successive generations to hand on their faith and their way of life to their children, and on the loyalty of children to the heritage of their past. Read that again. Judaism is a religion of continuity. It depends for its very existence on the willingness of successive generations to hand on their faith and way of life to their children, and on the loyalty of children to the heritage of their past. That is why the question is so rarely asked in Jewish history, and why we had to travel to 15th century Spain to find a precedent. At most times, Jews have seen themselves as a chosen, not a choosing people. Their identity was self-evident, a gift, a given of birth, a fact, not a decision. So what is the past? So when in the past Jews asked why they should continue to be Jewish, what was the answer? And that ends chapter 1. Chapter 2 begins answers, and we'll do that, God willing, next week. I want to thank you, Barry, for calling in, and everybody else who called in. I welcome you to Gulf Meadows Synagogue's School of Jewish Studies. We offer a lot of different things. This book club is just one of many. Please join us again next week for more book club. Tomorrow night, please join us for Tanakh Tuesday. We're starting 2 Kings. How exciting is that? Continuation of 1 Kings, Jewishly. But the Christians flipped the book up. Be that as it may, we're starting 2 Kings, chapter 1, verse 1, tomorrow night at 7:30. So please join us for that. And, of course, Intro to Talmud 101 every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday morning at 10:30. Glad you enjoyed. Hopefully you enjoyed the book club class. We'll continue next week with chapter 2, Answers. See you then. Have a great day. Thank you for joining me. Shmuel Plasker is signing off now from Mount Washington, outside Cincinnati, here on Monday, June 14, 2021, wishing everybody a healthy and successful day. Take care and be well. Bye-bye now.